Italy for the Gourmet Traveler is 14 years old now in its fifth edition and at 726 pages bigger than ever. Unlike most books of this kind, it doesn't limit itself to the major Italian cities and popular tourist food destinations. Fred Plotkin's guide covers pretty much all of Italy's gastronomic and enological heritage with listings of restaurants, my pronunciation is going to be terrible, trattorias, pizzerias, frigatorias, delicatessens, bakeries, markets, cooking schools, local festivals, and vineyards in hundreds of cities and towns in all the regions of Italy, including the islands of Sicily and Sardinia, plus 42 recipes. It's published by Kyle Books, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Fred Plotkin, who's been a longtime friend of New York Public Radio, back to our show. Hi.
Thank you, Leonard. Not only is the book bigger than ever, but so is the author.
Well, if you're going to have to check out all these places, I guess that's one of the prices you're going to have to pay.
Yeah.
You've been here in the past to talk about Italian food. You've written a number of cookbooks, but also about opera. And regular listeners will remember all of your appearances on The Next Big Thing when that was part of our schedule. Are the interests in Italian food and opera connected?
I call myself a pleasure activist. And that is not a hedonist, but that's someone who uses all of his senses and experiences pleasures through hearing, touch, sound, sight, and so forth, so that what is turned on for opera is also what's turned on for food and wine. I work in opera. I've been on the Met broadcast many times. I used to be the performance manager of the Met.
You've written about opera.
I've written about opera. Next week I'm going to work at the Opera Festival in Martina Franca. So it's still very much part of my life. And part of the way that I discovered all of this food is by working in opera companies all over Italy and tasting the local specialties.
Well, the book was published in 1997, the first time.
96 in the States, 97 in Britain.
And every 3 or 4 years, you have issued a new edition, an update. Do you go and visit every one of these places again?
I do. The point is that because I work in opera, when I enter a restaurant and I start babbling in Italian and asking them a detail about food, they say, well, why do you speak such good Italian? I work in opera. So then they don't know that I'm really there working on and updating my book. But it's necessary to go back all the time. I do this myself. I don't have a staff. And I travel constantly.
Well, new places are opening up. Places are closing. So
they do, but also
this could be a year-long thing.
One must. But I feel very strongly, people ask me about this. They say, why did you include that restaurant again? And I believe that if someone works to maintain quality and standards in a world where everything is slipping, I don't want to punish them for maintaining quality.
Well, I'm also assuming that although all places have restaurants that open and close, shops open and close, chefs move on, that there's a bit more stability in Italy than you might find in New York or
there's
London.
There's a great deal more stability. I think that what I would point out is there's a phenomenon there that's similar to what we have here. If you go into kitchens in many great New York restaurants, the people working there are from somewhere in Central or South America. In Florence now, many of the people in the kitchens are from China. And parts of Tuscany have people from Sri Lanka. And I've noticed that the Sri Lankans, more than any foreign group, have this remarkable knack for reproducing the Italian flavors exactly as they're done by Italians.
Have we been able to do that in this country? Because you've been going to Italy, I think, since 1973.
And
Italian food has changed a lot in New York since 1973. Have we gotten closer to the real thing?
I would say that I and a few of my colleagues, Carol Field, Corby Kummer, Arthur Schwartz, Lynn Casper, and a few others, have introduced the real flavors of Italy. What happens, I'm afraid, is that in New York, chefs decide that they have to improve upon the Italian flavors. And I have consulted to restaurants from which I subsequently withdrew my name because the chef had to express himself rather than honor a tradition. If you're an opera singer, you don't take Verdi and Puccini and then rewrite it. You sing it the way it was done because these are classics.
You went to Italy first as an undergraduate in Bologna?
Well, my very first visit was after high school, but then I studied at the University of Bologna, and I had a Fulbright and studied at the University of Pavia and worked at La Scala.
Well, you've said that Bologna may have the best cuisine in Italy. Why then isn't it as popular a tourist destination as Rome, Florence, or Venice?
Well, all of the books that were written by the great British travel writers are set in Rome, Florence, and Venice. And they extol the works of art there. These are beautiful cities, absolutely. But
does Bologna not have a decent museum?
It has an excellent museum, the Pinacoteca. And I've always wanted to write a book about Bologna, and I've asked for many years to do that, and publishers yawn because it doesn't have the connotation that these other places have. But Bologna is gorgeous.
Well, you also, as you said, were a Fulbright scholar working at La Scala.
That's right.
That's in Milan. Many tourists don't consider Milan a favorite destination.
Well,
they?
When I say Milan, they grimace and they say, oh, it's industrial. Well, yes, outside the city, it's industrial. But when people come to New York City, they don't go to our industrial zones. They go to the parts of New York that are famous.
Well, they go to the industrial zones now because they go to Williamsburg.
But that's where they live.
Matter.
But Milan has a wonderful cuisine. It's sort of meat and milk-based, which makes it different from most Italian cuisines. Excellent red wines that come from north of Milan. Very gracious people, very talented people. And it has Michelangelo's last sculpture. It has the Last Supper. It has the Brera Museum. It has Italy's most famous opera house. It has wonderful small museums that people don't go to and that have masterpieces in them.
So this is just a matter of Italy having certain places publicized and other places overlooked. You talk about some small towns that a traveler shouldn't pass by.
Well, what I did in the book was for every region, I selected what I call the classic town, which is not the best town, but the one that gathers within its walls a lot of what is typical. It may be the capital, such as Bologna in Emilia-Romagna, but in little regions like Molise, it's Larino, which is this little paradise of olive oil and bread that people would not want to miss. Martina Franco, where I'll be going next week in Puglia, is exquisite. And Syracuse in Sicily. And if you go to these towns, fewer tourists go, and therefore they maintain character, flavor, beauty.
Well, you can go to a lot of different places if you drive. The problem is driving in Italy can be rather scary because there are no speed limits, and some people can really get on your tail.
Well, I have news
for you.
Well,
we're talking about a small country, aren't we? It's about the size of New Mexico.
Of New Mexico, but I have news for you. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I don't know how to drive.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, I've traveled all over Italy for 37 years without knowing how to drive. I take public transport. I meet people. When I'm on a train in Italy, everybody talks about food. And inevitably, I've been invited to people's homes. And I would say, well, for example, Signore, you're from Naples, and tell me the secret of your tomato sauce. Oh, well, my mother's is the best. Come home with me, and you can taste my mother's sauce. Italians, it's their first topic of conversation, not politics, not the World Cup, food.
Fred Plotkin is here. His Italy for the Gourmet Traveler has just been updated again in its most comprehensive edition, and we should point out that it not only has all the everything you'd ever want to know about every restaurant and coffee bar and wine bar and whatever else you might come across in Italy, but also he talks about bookstores and festivals, and you talk about art.
Cooking schools, opera houses.
We mentioned that Italy is the size of New Mexico. So how has it developed so many different food traditions?
Italy, well, for one thing, Italy geographically is very divided. It has mountain ranges. It has river valleys. It has natural elements that have separated peoples for centuries. And add to that the fact that there have been many outside colonizers who have come in. Italy is a nation only since 1870, and in its present configuration only since 1954.
So this influence of Spain, of Austria, of Hungary.
All of these places. Turkey in northeastern Italy, for example. France to a considerable degree, Switzerland less. And just the native peoples who have lived there. The Greeks colonized much of southern Italy in ancient times. All of this DNA culturally and geographically is there.
You say that there, in the central areas, there are mountains and valleys so isolated that they were the last parts of the country touched by Christianity. We're talking about
the
first
region.
Country to be touched by
it's
Christianity.
It's true, but the Abruzzo, which is due east of Rome, had these natural barriers of these enormous mountains. People don't think of central Italy as having Alps, but these are huge mountains, and people could not get through there, and therefore the people who lived there were pagan. Not a negative judgment, but just pre-Christian, meaning pagan.
Reflected in some of the foods, like the Seven Virtues soup?
The Seven Virtues, that's a soup where you get seven virgins, if you can find them, and each one of them brings seven ingredients, because this notion of seven being positive, seven virgins, seven ingredients, 49 ingredients in the soup. It's made in a big pot. It's made at Easter time, which is the period of fertility, of rebirth, and it's still done.
Although it's olive oil and pasta in the south and butter and rice in the north, can we say that there is a certain Italian culinary sensibility that ties it all together?
I think that the sensibility is that people are still attuned to seasonality. It's declining a bit when you have vegetables arriving from South America and bananas from Africa and so on. But for the most part, an Italian looks forward to the first cherry of the season. They're called primizie. And whenever you eat a fruit or a vegetable for the first time each year, you pause and you say a little prayer.
I remember the first time I went to Italy, and before the word locavore had been coined, I was aware of the fact that most of the stuff that I was eating in a restaurant had come from over that hill that I saw the distance. The wine probably had been grown about 2 feet away from the vegetables. And that's dying. Why? Italy always produced such flavorful produce.
It has. I would say that produce in Italy has become a bit of a problem because I'm afraid the European Union has been damaging. Italy had, before the European Union, higher food standards in terms of agriculture and care. Now, for example, in Trentino, which had many apple varieties, most of them were pulled up. So they grow Golden Delicious, not for the Italians, but to go into strudel in Austria and Germany. And Italy has become a supplier of, quote, product throughout the European Union, and that has brought down the regionality, but not in Naples, which is still incredible for food.
Well, Italy is where the slow food movement began.
25 years ago. Yeah.
But at the same time, are you seeing more jarred sauces in the supermarkets?
There have always been jarred sauces.
And McDonald's has been near the Spanish Steps for a long time.
Well, there used to be a bar in the Spanish Steps that I went to, and that was the first McDonald's. When I lived in Bologna, they tried to open one there in 1975, and there were riots in the streets. But now the spot where they tried to open it has a McDonald's.
What makes the food of Bologna special?
You have a confluence of rivers, mountains, and sea nearby. So you have a vast plain where wheat comes from. You have pigs and cattle that live nearby. The pigs go on to greater glory as prosciutto and mortadella. And the cattle produce milk that becomes Parmigiano-Reggiano. You have all these great elements. The mountain food gives mushrooms and so on. And because there has always been this wealth of ingredient, it was not a poor cuisine. It evolved over many centuries.
If somebody just wanted to go to Italy for 1 week and stay in one general area, where would you suggest?
I always ask them what other interests they have because you have to do things other than eat. Mm-hmm. I adore Liguria, the Italian Riviera. To me, it has the food that we would think of as the Mediterranean diet. Pesto is from there, focaccia, fish, great vegetables. It's gorgeous, but there's not much to do there unless you go to Genoa, which is a fantastic city, or you go to San Remo, which has a wonderful market. But it's just about nature and pleasure. But I think another region that I would send people to is the Marche. The Marche has seashore hills, wonderful historic towns, great opera festivals, fantastic food, good-looking people.
And Piero della Francesca.
Also.
You were...
And Raphael.
You were a guest blogger at the New York Times last month, and you answered a wide range of questions. One was from Betty Fussell, the well-known food writer, who asked, what's the biggest difference between the coffee you get in Italy and what you get here, sold as espresso, etc.?
Well, the problem here, as I was talking about the food before, is we exaggerate everything. The gentleman who founded Starbucks claims that he was inspired in Milan to create a Milanese-type cafe. For one thing, in Milan, you go in, you have a quick sip of fantastic coffee in a small cup that's made at the moment. It's not hyped up with extra caffeine. And then you leave. You don't sit down, open your Wi-Fi, and sit for hours and cruise the internet. You go in to have this brief moment. They call it the pausa del cafe, the pause, where your busy day, you stop for a moment, you talk to a friend, and then you go on your way. A cappuccino is never had after about noon because the milk weighs on your stomach. We intensify everything. There would never be 20 ounces of coffee to an Italian. That's a heart attack.
And they don't give you a little bit of lemon rind with your espresso.
No, that happened. People always ask me about that because when Neapolitans came here about 100 years ago, they couldn't afford good coffee, so that they would, quote, correct the coffee by putting lemon rind around the rim of the coffee cup to blunt the bad flavor of the bad coffee. Coffee in Naples now is sensational, and you would never, ever add lemon to it.
So you're going back, you said next week?
Next week. I'll be
opera connected.
Opera connected. I'll be in Puglia. I'll be in Basilicata, Campania, Lazio. In Tuscany, I'm teaching for Georgia State University a food seminar, and then I'm going up to Torino. So in all of these places, I'll be going back to the ones that I knew. I know that Martina Franca needs a bit of an update, and finding new places, always anonymously.
Although I'm assuming that because you have a distinctive look, Fred, that some of those people must say, oh, here comes that American who speaks very good Italian, knows a lot about opera, and writes those books.
No, but they don't know me from the books, and they think I look like Luciano Pavarotti. And so I come in, and they hug me, and they kiss me, and we eat, and I leave, and they have no idea I'm the same guy. I don't put my picture in the book.
You say Italians are not foodies, so they say food is part of their identity. But aren't they opening up very fancy restaurants in the big cities?
They are. I mean, foodie is a term that my colleague Paul Levy claims to have coined in 1984, and it has a sense of acquisition about it. It doesn't mean someone who loves food. We all love food, but they're not trendy in the same way, and if they are trendy, they collapse very quickly. What Italians still understand, despite everything, is that if you respect the ingredient, if you know how to buy it, select it at its peak, and respect its properties, then you're a good cook.
Well, this is a big book, but some people are going to be willing to schlep this around this summer.
Yes.
What is the state of the euro these
days? The state of the euro, actually, I was in Italy in June, and it had dropped, so it's now $1.25, whereas last year it was $1.60, so that means we're doing better.
Mm-hmm. And is Italy still a travel bargain?
Italy has not been a travel bargain in about 15 years, but one can eat very well there without spending much money. Hotels are a little pricey, so we've come up now with bed and breakfast and other alternatives, but one can eat really well there, spending a lot less than we do here for comparable Italian food.
Of course, there's the other side. There's Berlusconi, but we won't discuss that right now.
No, it turns my stomach.
Do you? My experience in Italy was whenever I said anything and made a face when I mentioned his name, people got offended.
Well,
so he's still very popular.
Well, he's popular. Well, today, for example, there are no newspapers being published and no broadcast media because he's trying to create a gag law. In other words, saying that newspapers should not invade people's privacy. They mean his privacy. Unfortunately, he controls 6 of the 7 television networks and the biggest publishing house.
Fred Plotkin's Italy for the Gourmet Traveler, now in its 5th edition, updated again, published by Kyle. Thank you so much for coming by and talking about
it. Grazie, Leonardo.